Well, I'm pleased to say I'm joined by pressure punter Roger Brooke, known as Big Roger or Fat Roger to those who know and love you. But thank you for joining us here today at Hove Greyhound Stadium, where you have spent how many happy days and months and years of your life?
I've been coming since I was 12, Julie. I'm 55 now for my sins. And here we are at 1:40 on a Thursday afternoon. The first race is 6:27. So I've got nearly 5 hours to sort myself before the first race. But anyway, moving on. I mean, I've been coming here and going open racing ever since I was a kid, like I was 12 years old, and I got bought by me two best pals at senior school, their mother and father, Barley and Jenny Southern. They bought me here on Boxing Day when I was 12 years old, and I've got to be honest, I know you weren't meant to, but I had a 10p reverse forecast which paid £2.26, and I thought it was Rothschild. So course, fell in love with the game straight away, and it within 6 months I was coming to every meeting off my own back, and I used to walk out here from my home, which was right near Brighton Racecourse, which used to take me best part of an hour, like, but I was a lot fitter then. I could do that, you know. I was only a whipper of a kid. It was when I was 18 or so that I put on all the weight, and here I am now, known as Big Rog, alias Fat Rog. But I used to go open racing. I used to abscond from school, if I'm being honest, to go dog racing from the age of 13 and whatever. We used to go and see all the big races in London. Occasionally go further afield with a friend of ours, an old boy by the name of Jeff Bodner. I haven't seen him for years. Hopefully he's still alive, but I honestly don't know. But we used to go away every, like, four times a week we go away. Like, my greyhound week would be, in them days, it would probably be Romford or Catford on a Monday night. It would be Hove on a Tuesday. And sometimes I only raced Thursday and Saturday then. But anyway, I used to come Tuesday. Wednesday, I'd probably go back to Romford. And Thursday, I'd always be here. Friday, used to love Portsmouth. Friday, every single Friday, we used to go down, me and my pal Jack and his Mrs. Nina and my best pal Dave. Dave Lord, we used to go down there, and they used to have a little gas fire on the cheap side, as I always used to call it, the cheap side. We all used to sit round it because it was absolutely freezing cold in the winter and what have you. Portsmouth was a cold place, but like the amount of characters that come out of Portsmouth, I mean, if there was 300 or 400 people there on a Friday night, the majority of them were proper dog people. You know, when you go to these tracks and what have you, that's the one thing you always fall back on. You don't see so many dog people nowadays, which is unfortunate. I know the industry is going a different direction and they're probably playing towards the younger people and what have you. But, you know, I mean, even when we used to go to Ireland, we used to always go to Cork for the Laurels, myself, Alf Ash, Sean Gresham. And we used to go every year. We always used to go to Yule on the Friday night, and that's my favourite track in Ireland. And I think, by the way, I think it's a very good place to buy dogs out of. You get bargains out of Yule and what have you. I mean, for instance, Taylor Skye come out of Yule. And I've always liked going to Ireland. I mean, when I owned dogs, I had them over there with Graham Holland in the main, and we had a couple with Skippy Gilbert, Desi Gilbert and Marie Gilbert. And in the main, though, we had them with Graham Holland. And in the end, I stopped owning dogs about 7 or 8 years ago because I've got to be honest, like, I found it a big expense, if I'm being honest. I mean, we had a dog, my favourite dog we owned was Hondo Dingle. He made the quarterfinal of the English Derby, what you would say was an inadequate trip. He was trained by Derek Knight, done a marvellous job with him and what have you. And then he went to the Champion Stakes at Romford, and he was favourite at the semi-final stage, and he got knocked out. So we thought we'd try and take him to Ireland, see how he fared in Ireland, because he had a sister who, by the way, was the best named dog ever. Perfectly bred, she was called. Anyway, and she had a smidgen of class about her, but she kept falling in season. So anyway, we went over there with a view to hopefully win some prize money to pay for the mating. Well, the first time he ran, he was in a 1,500 euro invitation at Cork, which he won. He then was invited to a €1,000 one-off at Thurles, which he won. And then 2 weeks after the Irish Derby finished, we went for a competition called the Tote Retention, which was €10,000 to the winner. Well, lo and behold, he won it. And we all went over there for the final. And Dennis Fury and myself, one of my pals who owned the dog with us, he took me to Navan Races, and we had a little kitty that day, I'll never forget it. We put in €200, 100 each. I said, I'll leave the horses to you, Den, and you leave the dogs to me tonight. So we went there, and he had €50 on the last winner. It was the case 50, I think it was about 12 to 1. Like, lovely price. Unusual for Ireland, about 12 to 1 winner in Ireland, it's like 33 to 1 winner over here. But anyway, so we went to Shelbourne, and I was Bilko material. Every single dog I picked kept winning. Anyway, we turned it in to nearly €8,000.
Wow.
And Ondo Dingle won the final. We had a grand on him in the final.
What a day.
So that was one of my best racing days in terms of gambling.
So you're obviously really, really enthusiastic about your greyhound racing. But you talked about when you were a kid and you obviously got that buzz from just having that 10p bet. So was it greyhound racing that got you into gambling, or gambling that got you into greyhound racing?
Greyhound racing got me into gambling.
Right.
Full stop. I mean, you know, as a kid, my family, no one had a penny in the family and what have you. So, like, mum and dad had no money to spoil us. So I used to go to my mum's works, and I used to borrow a fiver off her when I was 14 and 15. And I've got to be truthful, I turned her upside down, bless her. It was only when I got to about 20 where, like, I made everything right of her and what have you. I used to send her away on holiday twice a year and what have you. Anyway, I'm not playing my own trumpet, but there you go. Don't worry, she said I was good to her, so that's fair enough. And my dad. Like I say, I mean, if I come out here when I was a kid, if I come out here with £2, if I went home with £4, I thought I'd had a touch. Mm. Because A, I got enough for the next meeting, because that's how a gambler's mind works and what have you. Obviously, I couldn't go in betting shops then. I used to stand outside them, but I couldn't go in betting shops then, what have you. Little whippersnapper with a pair of shorts on, Julie, believe it or not. Have to be a big... bigger now, the Schultz, but anyway, that's another story. Like I say, I was going open racing. I mean, my first experience of open racing away from home was Wembley. I went to see the St. Ledger where Kilmagora missed, beat, I think Black Earl was a favourite. Black Earl was a massive headliner, Sporting Life light headliner every single time it ran. And there was a guy around, an old guy, absolutely respected in the business, all the old school would have known him, Jack Huss his name was, and I used to sit with him at Romford on the cheap side underneath, and he used to go there, and he always said to me, he was a northern guy, he said, never back headliners, laddie, he said, you'll never get any money back in headliners, you know. And I always remember him saying that and what have you. But it's a bit different now, I mean, because in them days they would nap up like Black Earl and it'd be 7-4 on. I mean, you know, people like Jonathan Kay and Phil Donaldson and whoever does the Racing Post and what have you now, they wouldn't even dream of tipping up an odds on chance. You know, it's like when you go on the programme with the Racing Post TV, if you tip an odds on chance, you get snarled at.
We do a bit.
That's it. So, you know, I mean, it's not sort of
The done thing. What age did you become a professional punter then? What age did you make a living from it?
I mean, I've never called myself a professional punter, but I would say I got good
at... But you've made a living from it. You've never done anything else.
I got better at it when I was early mid-30s.
Okay.
And I would say 10 years ago, I'm a far better judge of a dog than what I am now, although I get by. I think that was my golden spell.
What's
about
the difference?
15
Why?
Years ago. I just think, like... Nowadays, you see so many dogs, you know, and you're flooded with it and what have you, you know. And although I like the game, I mean, you know, I find myself watching Racing Post TV. You know, when it went seven nights, I was watching it more sporadically, if I'm being honest. But, you know, I like the Friday night meetings at Romford, and I used to love it when this place was on and what have you. I mean, obviously, I used to go on there now and again. But... you know, and you enjoy it. I mean, you're going on there and you're giving your opinions and what have you. Some may agree, some may not, you know, and if asked questions, I'll always speak as I see it, you know. I never hide behind the screen, so to speak, you know. But, you know, in terms of ground racing nowadays, in terms, like you say, we all know that they're heading towards the younger generation. I'm not saying they're casting the older owners and the middle-aged owners out to cast, but they are aiming at the younger people. They're looking for
and
people.
And that's necessary, yeah, isn't it?
Well,
to
of
keep
course,
it going.
Of course, it's necessary to get it going, but they need to educate them about the racing side of it, rather than the. Cool. Trying to think of the word. The hospitality side, if you like, you know, you know, the bar and the food and this, that, and the other. And the one thing you got to do is get the food right at these places, you know. Like, I mean, Hove, we're here now, they've had a refurb and they've made a good job of it. You got a young racing manager come in now, Daniel Rankin, who's got his own ideas. He's got his own ideas about the game, and he comes with a good profile, you know, good background and what have you. And the course of time tells me that he'll have plenty of positive feedback, you know. But you still got to get it right, you know, the grading side of it and the owners and, you know, the trainers speak for the owners. I think the owners should speak for the owners, personally. I've always thought that. I mean, I've got to be truthful. In my days of owning dogs here, I probably had six bones of contention with Peter Miller, the racing manager. And I've got to be truthful, I think I know what I'm looking at. He was right 5.5 times out of six. So there you have it, you know. That's just in terms of my dogs and what have you. And, you know, I mean, the one thing as a gambler, a professional gambler, whatever, when you're doing dog racing, never disrespect your racing manager. How did he do that? How did he do this? How did he do this? You know, the net result is they're a lot cleverer in the main than you give them credit for. That's the one thing. I mean, I've always looked at that. We've had good racing managers here, you know. I mean, in my youth, we had Jim Layton. And then Peter Miller took the mould and he was here, I would guess, for 15, 20 years, Peter Miller, you know. And they've been shuffling around upstairs for like 18 months, 2 years now, and now Daniel Rankin's arrived, and he's definitely come out the blocks in terms of his ideas and what have you. Rumour has it he's going to be bringing in handicap racing, and he must be a good grader, let me tell you, because he used to grade umpteen handicaps up north in Shawfield. He never give a dog more than 12. That's a sign of a good grader.
Yeah. Things that's are certainly looking very positive here at Hove.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So, Roger, you've never done anything else. You've always been a punter, albeit you don't class yourself as a professional punter. It has paid for a nice life for you. What do you need to be a successful professional punter? And for people watching this who are aspiring to be that, what qualities do they need?
A proper professional punter, Julie, has got to have discipline. And it's always been my Achilles heel. You know, greyhounds, I'll sit myself in the room with anybody when I've done the work, and I'll fare well against most people, you know. But my vice has always been football. I can't watch a game of football and not funk for 6, 7, 8 goals, like, and what have you. I bet silly amount of goals, and literally I've done a fortune on it. Like, the mug element has eaten me alive. It's almost like a disease, like people take drugs and people smoke and drink and what have you, like, you know, I just couldn't watch a game of football without betting untold goals.
And it's interesting because would you class yourself as a gambling addict?
Ooh, I suppose I'd go over the 50% barrier, if I'm being honest, yeah.
But
you
in know, dogs, I always try to be in honest. Dogs it makes you money, so dogs, you sort of wouldn't class now, that as a gambling addiction, but then you lose it on football, which could be potentially be a problem for
the
you.
The last 6 to 9 months, I have focused on greyhound racing, and consequently I've been doing a lot better, you know. I have the odd football bet, but that is what I have now. I'm not like compulsive with it like I used to be, and like it cost me multi thousands, like, you know, but now it's under control as such. And
do you think it'll stay that way?
I hope so, because, like, you know, the format of it is, listen, gambling can be infectious. You know, I know the government send out, like, warnings and this, that and the other, and the firms promote responsible gambling and what have you, but, you know, I'm not so sure about that. I think they pick and choose their victims, so to speak. Mm. But anyway, that's another thing. In terms of professional dogs, I think the greatest asset you've got if you're a dog video watcher, you've got to have a good angle on the video. Like, I bet a Sheffield, and you are looking at the video straight down the track. You know if a dog turns left, turns right, runs straight, etc., etc. And believe you me, that is more paramount than pace. Without any shadow of a doubt, draws are more paramount than pace. Pace will always look after itself if the dog's drawn right. You know, if you back 10 dogs out of one that you make your so-called nap, you back 10 dogs out of six, you make your so-called nap, you'll do better than betting 2, 3, 4, and 5. Perhaps 3 at some tracks is a good trap, obviously. Yeah. I mean, you know, but in principle, your strike rate would be much better. And that's because you perceive them as very well drawn. You know, and you know, you get dogs turning left from 5, dogs turning right from 2, and if they run their lanes, these dogs, they go forward, and normally they're early pace types that you make good bets. It's not clever making a nap of a strong runner, really. You know,
you're a sort of larger than life personality. You're obviously, you like to have a lot of fun in life.
Yeah.
But what about the mental toughness of being a professional gambler? Do you struggle with, for example, when you have losing runs? Does it get you down?
No, I never let it get me down. Honestly,
have losing runs, right?
Of course I do. I'm absolutely straight laced about it. Anybody who knows me, I get up in the morning and get on with it. You know, I'll do a couple of grand previous night, and the next morning I'm up doing the card when I have to do it, or in the afternoon, whatever. And, like, you know, by the tea time, I know what I'm going to do tomorrow. If the circumstances prevail and the prices prevail. But obviously nowadays, with the early prices, and I'm not privy to them like I used to be, it's getting harder because, like, these firms, they just completely and utterly overreact to the first initial bet, and dogs become false. But unfortunately, people follow through because, you know, the ordinary gambler on the street is infectious. If they see a dog's been 3-1, it's now 6-4, they want to be on it. They want to be on it, whether you want to be on it or not. That's a different kettle of fish. But if you do want to be on it by choice, then you're out the market on the value element. And the one thing I can tell you, Julie, I will say this. When I've done the work on a card, I'll lock myself in a room, anyone with prices. And I promise you, fake, I can make a dog a nap, but I'll make it a 2-1 chance. If they want to take evens, let them take it. They won't be getting mine, whether it wins or loses. Because I know if your opinion's good, it'll outstay that sort of scenario. I mean, 2-1 to evens is 17%. If there's a man alive who wins 17% gambling, you bring them to me. Because I promise you, Fabe, there's not one alive. And you have to turn over a lot of money to win a lot of money at 17%. And there's not many people who can do that, if any.
What sort of bets do you have mostly? Is it singles like that?
I don't mind having singles. I'll tell you what I like. I've got to be truthful. Is say, like, I make a dog 4 or 5 to 1, and it's 8 or 10 to 1 on Betfair. I'll have more on that than a short one. You know, I'll back it to win 2 or 3 grand. No problem at all. My scenario has always been, if you're right with the big one, get the money. That's always the way. You know, I mean, listen, anyone can have a even monkey, 600 or 4, etc., etc., etc. You won't go forward, Julie. I don't care who you are. But obviously, professional people in gambling are perceived as them sort of prices, and sometimes lower. I mean, you look at Harry Findlay, you know, with respect to Harry, professional odds on punter in his pomp and what have you. But his greatest asset was he got money out of champions. Tiger Woods, Pete Sampras, you know, all the champions at their sport, he used to centre around the Steve Davis. That was his first calling card, Steve Davis. And the one thing about Harry, whatever people say about Harry, he's lived life to the full, purely because of gambling.
Yeah, you know,
and his personality, infectious personality. You know, not everybody would like him, but not everybody would like me. That's how life is. But the fact remains is, he's a very infectious person, generous person, and what have you. And yes, he can be outspoken. You know, I know. Just getting off the subject slightly, I mean, I know Coventry broke him in terms of the Greyhound game. You know, I mean, he put his life and soul into that, and it just never panned out like, you know, how he hoped it would. And it really, it, you know, it took him a while to get over it, you know, because I do speak to Harry on occasions and what have you. But, you know, he's still battle away, still do his bits and bobs and what have you, you know.
You mentioned that football betting is a bit of a weakness for you, and often you can lose what you've punted on dogs in football. What about other areas of your gambling? Is there anything else you'd like to improve?
Well, basically, now I've become like centre based on ground racing. I think I've channeled my thoughts well enough on that, you know. And you know, I bet on horses on Saturdays. I'll go into the town and bet in Betfred shops and what have you, you know, because I think Betfred's the fairest bookie on the high street. Mm. If I'm being honest, like he offers his punters a concession most days and what have you. Whether they choose to take it is another matter, you know. And he offers them for £100 stake, which is a fair amount as well for the man on the street, you know, up to £100 stake. So I'll find him fine, you know, Betfred. I do like dealing with him.
You've mentioned one or two sort of well-known people in terms of punting already, but was anyone ever a mentor for you? And what did you learn? Or are you self-taught?
Self-taught, definitely. Self-taught. I had no mentors. I mean, I had a fella used to put on for me for 25, 30 years, who sadly passed away a couple of years ago, by the name of Terry Tribe. I worked for him in his betting shop. He had the most successful independent in the South Coast. He used to trade under the name Harrison's, and he used to bet on flies up a wall, literally, Julie. We used to walk in the shop at 8:30 in the morning, and by 9:30, the whole shop was covered in posters of betting on this, that, and he used to bet on local football. He used to lay a grand on a football game 25 years ago. Like, you know, this is before, like, it's become what it is now. You know, I mean, like, he'd have Hastings Town against Eastbourne Borough. Like, a fella would come in and have a 15 under the 10 and he'd lay them. I mean, it's a bit of a bet to show someone off the street on a game of football, like local football and what have you. But he was a chairman of a football club himself, so, like, he had some input there, like, you know. But, you know, other people, I mean, untold people, like, I talked to in the game and what have you, like, who I would say were good people, you know. I mean, but I've got to be true, doggy pals in terms of owners. My pals are Alf Ash.
Are they big gamblers, these guys?
Alf, he can have a bet, like, but he's good player up of his money. He wouldn't leave it behind. Sean Gresham, who for the benefit of the camera is a professional bock, I must say, he's a professional bock. I couldn't tip him out of bed, unfortunately, but lovely fella. And his pal Phil Chatfield, who trains at Paul as well, like, he's my pal from we met him in 2000 in Clonmel, and we never looked back since. So I've got to be true, I'm not in touch with him as much as I used to be the last 3 or 4 years, but like, we did meet up at the Derby last year. We had a lovely weekend, like, you know. But I expect we'd do it again this year.
So you've mostly been a professional punter, but you have also run a book here as well at Brighton, not for yourself, but on behalf of somebody else.
Yeah.
Did your punting nature help or hinder you doing that?
Probably hindered me. I mean, I used to represent Mark Green when we had a pitch here and what have you, and he in principle was the bookie, and I used to run the floor sometimes, Clark and what have you. I was what you call a good all-round egg, and we was a good partnership, chalk and cheese. Like, he was firm but fair on the stall, and I was sort of, if you like, the I know everyone person sort of thing, you know. Everyone used to like come and have a chat, and I used to chat to him and what have you. But we had a good working relationship, you know, and he's remained my pal ever since, like, we left We left the stadium under unfortunate circumstances, but there you have it.
Making a book, though, did you always take your own view?
I always took my own view, and Mark used to play to the money. I used to make a view, and if I tell you, every single time I bet, I always used to fall on the sword once a night. You know, I might win, or I might lose, but I'd have one bad race, because I used to bet to my opinion. I always, like, you know, if a dog was 5-2 and I thought he represented 4-1, I'd be the first one to go 3. And if they backed it and they bet it back in at 5-2, 2-1, I'd put it in again, like, sort of thing, which is the art of bookmaking in principle, you know. But I did have the savvy to know that even though I made it 4-1, if they want to take 3 and 5-2, like, you know, in the end, they're going to shut you up as a bookmaker, you know. I mean, if you go in them days that I was betting, it was already the amount of trade was already receding. So from the point of view of playing to big numbers, you know, if you bet on Derby night, for argument's sake, like at Towcester, I watched Ben Keith working the star tools, like they were taking good money, taking money on the phone and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I'd love to work in that environment and what have you, because at least you could execute a plan, because, like, you know, you're going to lay plenty of dogs. But by the time I was doing it here, it was already like you had empty columns.
I'm guessing you love the camaraderie of the betting ring as well.
I like the camaraderie. I mean, when I used to be punting out here, I would say middle to late 90s, like, you know, every time I used to move for a dog, like, it used to shorten every time, whether I was right or wrong. You know, but that, like I say to you, that was when I probably, like, from my 30s onwards, that's when I probably become, in brackets, a better judge.
Yeah.
A better judge. Mind you, I'd already had 15, 18 years experience, so I was entitled to get the hang of it in the end,
yeah.
Julie.
You started
fairness.
Very young.
Yeah,
as a successful professional punter, do you have or sort of face the same issues that many other punters do with accounts and keeping them open? And
accounts.
And what
accounts,
about Betfair as well?
I get people to open accounts and what have you, and They're becoming few and far between. Like I say, the main off-course bookmakers, they don't want to take the bets they used to, which is somewhat understandable, but unfortunate. And, you know, that's the way the game's going now and what have you. You know, in the end, they say they do industry SPs. I'm not so sure about that, but, you know, we'll see how we go with that one. But in terms of, well, you know, accounts are accounts now, that's it.
So you use friends, family?
I use friends, family, friends of friends.
Betfair?
You know. Betfair I use, yeah. Betfair, I've always been quite heavy user on Betfair, you know, especially dogs and what have you.
But then I'm guessing with Betfair, because you have tended to lose money elsewhere, do you pay the 40% commission?
No. I wouldn't stand for that. I'd move on. I'd move on to someone else. Yeah, I wouldn't stand for that.
Another account or another firm?
No, I'd move on to another account.
Right.
And if I found the person responsible for charging 40%, I'll politely put a rope around their neck and hang them from the nearest door. But there you have it. That's an opinion best left unsaid, I suppose. But it has been said. There you go.
How do you see the future of greyhound racing?
The future of greyhound racing. Now, if we use Hove and Romford as the two latest examples who've had a refurb and tried to go forward and go, I mean, Romford, I mean, every Friday night they're on there and they do interviews with somebody from the track at some stage and what have you. Karen, who's there and what have you, lovely girl. I've met her a couple of times down here. She's a lovely girl and, you know, she's completely committed to the course, you know, so hopefully she'll get her just desserts in terms of results and what have you. And Romford, like, seems to be ticking along nicely again now that it's open and what have you. And Hove, you know, I mean, we're always all right on a Saturday night, but we need to get people through the door perhaps on a Thursday night. And to do that, I suppose you've got to be looking at cheaper drinks. You've got to be looking at better food, if you like, better food or better costing food, etc. I mean, people, they want to eat, people, they want to drink.
Yeah.
And the absolute ace in the hole with anything is free admission. Listen, Brighton races once a year, they used to have a free admission. I swear to you, you get people coming from nowhere to go to Brighton Race because it's free to go through. And the first one through here, run up the bar and pay £40 a round of drinks. But if you said to him, you've got to pay 15, 20 quid to get in, I'm not going up there.
But then that model didn't work at Toaster, did it?
No, perhaps it didn't. But, you know, in terms of, the thing about Toaster is anyone who went there within reason probably travelled. And, you know, I mean, I went there 3 or 4 times. That's all I went there in the time it was open. Because, like, you know, I mean, I've got no transport. I mean, I rely on Alf when I go and what have you. I went there with Alf 3 or 4 times. We went for the derby and we had a bloody good night, like, you know, good weekend. Like, you know, we went for the final 48, which is always the best night, the last 48, because you walk out after the last 48 and in your own mind, you've got a 2 or 3 shortlist, you know, for the outright winner and what have you. And I've been blessed with getting that right a few times over the years, you know. Probably my best anti-post was probably, with help from me and Riley, was probably Droopy Skulls.
Oh, really?
When he won in, I think it was 2005 or 6 from memory. But he said to me, when I was introduced to him, his kennels by Paul Carpenter, and we went up there one Saturday. Anyway, he said, I've got these two pups here, got taken for a gallop. Droopy's Kale, who went on to win the Harold's Cross Puppy Derby, and Droopy Skulls. Anyway, so we went down to this gallop, and he's let off Droopy's Kale. He's come up there like, ba-dum, 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 like he's come up lovely. I said, oh, we can run, like, you know. Then all of a sudden, he let off Droopy's Skulls, and I'm telling you, Julie, it was like a train coming up there. You knew everything about the dog. He was just, you know, I think he was 14 or 15 months. I said, Jesus, I said, this is some dog. And I said to Paul Carpenter when he come up, I said, cool. He said, I've never seen nothing like it. He said, it was like a train coming. Anyway, lo and behold, the first 4 or 5 races of his career, and then, he was the talking dog. Then Premier Fantasy come along because he won the semi-final of the Comerford and went on in the final. And he was always the headliner out of the two. But unfortunately, as we all now know, Premier Fantasy had become the dominant dog in that year's derby at the semi-final stage. But unfortunately, he broke a leg at the second bend in the semi-final. And for all intents and purposes, was the right dog at that given time. But anyway, Droopy Skulls, I know for a fact, because Ian had kept me informed, because I was like double pally with Ian in them days and what have you. I'm still pally with him now. But he told me his dog is not 100%. He said, I think I could find something. He said, I've just got to be lucky enough to make the final. And when he made the final, he said, I'm sure we win now. I never get it. He took over from Tim's Crow just after the bridge of the third bend. And he went on to beat, funny enough, a Hove dog, Big Freeze. Brian Clemenson's dog was running on for second. But that was a proper touch for me. I won good money on that. And I've got to be truthful, a lot of it was down to Ian Riley and also the fact that I saw that gallop that given morning before he even went on the track. Like, I was fixated with the dog, you know. And he then went to the Irish Derby. I think he was 4-1 favourite. I think he got knocked out early, and that was basically the falling away of Droopy Skulls. But he's a hell of a dog, hell of a dog, you know.
We've talked about your vices on the gambling final. I want to talk a little bit about your personal life, because you touched on the fact that you're known as Fat Roger. And you have another vice, don't you, that is part of the reason for that? Chocolate.
Yeah, no, diabetes, Julie. I'm heavily diabetic. I've been diabetic now for 20, 21 years, something like that. And it's got me now. Like, you know, I've abused it, and I've got to be truthful, I'm suffering nowadays. You know, I look all right on the camera and what have you, but I do suffer with it. And it's all self-imposed and what have you. So, you know, I'm funny enough, I went to the doctor's dietitian nurse on Tuesday, the diabetic nurse, sorry, and she gave me a proper ticking off. So we just have to see how that one goes.
No more drinking with Seamus Cahill then.
Well, I don't know about drinking with Seamus Cahill, but he always buys me 2 bottles, but it's going to have to be 1. I'll give him the text and said it's 1 tonight, like, instead of 2.
Does it bother you, the nickname Fat Roger?
I come out of here pie-eyed on a Thursday. The nickname Fat Roger, it come from a pal of mine. He just called me it once, and like everyone sort of refers to it, Big Roger or Fat Roger, you know. I would say the polite people call me Big Rog.
I'll call you Big Rog. I want to finish by just asking you, whilst we're here at Hove, and, you know, I love this track. Best dog you've seen here?
Listen, the best dog that ever lived, 500 yards and above, was Ballyregan Bob. He's the best stayer by 2.5 to 3 lengths that's ever graced 6 bends. If he ever run 8 bends, he'd have turned track records inside out, because every single race he ran away after the line from top class opposition. If he'd have had a match race over 500 metres against any dog, he'd have beaten it, a match race. In the context of a 6 dog race, Westmead Hawk might have beat Ballyregan Bob. But I can assure you, in a 2 dog race, you'd have been living on fresh air, because Ballyregan Bob would have led him. And Ballyregan Bob would have been stronger than him. Although that's hard to believe, that is literally how good he was, you know. And we all know, you go back through the races of the decade, the race of the decade in the 80s was Ballintubber 1 and Ballyregan Bob in the Trainers' Championship at Walthamstow. Possibly the best final of the 80s was the Yankee Express Pall Mall, when he beat Longspell and Glatton Grange, among others. And you look at the races. Obviously, the race of the 2000s was the semi-final when Westmead all picked up Mineola Farlo. I mean, that was just incredible. In terms of English racing, that was just unbelievable. But, you know, I think the best race I ever see was a dog of George Curtis's in the 70s. I think her name was Clounty Comment. Anyway, she ran with a dog called Silver Lady in a 7.92 at Portsmouth. They were both 100% genuine. And they ran, there wasn't a head between them all the way round. And they went over the line together, and giving you this detail, I can't remember what won, but it was a short head. It's the best race you'll ever see. Yeah. And I think they broke the track record in doing so. Best race I've ever seen in terms of head-to-head buckle. Because like when you build up a match race stroke, a buckle, it doesn't fall like that. But these two dogs literally were like that all the way around. It's absolutely fantastic. But, you know, I mean, so many good dogs.
So many good memories for you as well.
So many good memories. Jesus, we've won all sorts of finals as owners and what have you, you know. I mean, this day and age, I mean, funny enough, I've been out of dog ownership for 7 years, but I've got a leg in a pup with Teresa and Seamus Cahill. That's currently in Ireland being reared. It's about 8-9 months old now. It's out Ballinakilbiddy, a second litter, because I always said to Seamus, I'd like to have a say in one of the pups if there was one going and what have you. And he spoke to the owners, among them Tony, Northern Tony, who he owns plenty of good dogs with Jimmy Wright and etc. up there. And lovely fella. And I used to see him at Clonmel, and sometimes he comes here in the summer and what have you, like when he's got big race runners and what have you. But we're hoping we might get lucky there. Like, there's 4 of us in it, so it hasn't cost a lot. So
it's always the exciting stage when they're puppies. But
of course.
I'm glad to hear that you've enjoyed your life in greyhound racing, and I'm going to call you Big Roger.
Big Roger. Be polite.
Thank you so much for talking to Star Sports today.
That's fine.
And keep punting and stay away from the football.
Stay away from the football, keep punting and sort them greyhounds out, that's it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, lovely.
It's not just online betting at Star Sports. You can call us too on 08000 521 321 and speak directly to one of our friendly and experienced traders. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.